This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association member, FDIC.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI.
Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Hey, this is Annie, and you're listening to Stuff Mom Never Told You. We have a special update classic today because I am joined by my friend Samantha.
Hello.
Samantha is helping me out for this one. As listeners, I hope you know, a couple of weeks ago, I had my friend Sanam on the show to do an episode all about Asian American identity. And as part of that episode, we talked about the stereotypes around Madama Butterfly and Miss Saigon and all those stereotypes, all those works of art that helped make this stereotype of kind of the dainty Asian doll, like the submissive Asian doll. And it helped make this Asian fetish a thing. And that is something you and I have talked about for Samantha, because you are also Asian and have run into you.
Exactly. So I am Korean. Mm-hmm. And of course, first question is, what are you? Mm-hmm. And remember, it's what are you? In which I'm like, what? And like, no, where are you from? And because I'm also adopted, I automatically say LJ, Georgia. And they're like, no, but where are your parents from? Which is even better because I'm like, they're also from LJ, Georgia. He goes, but yeah. Where were you originally? What's your ethnicity?
Oh,
which ends up being like a four-part conversation just trying to mess with them.
Mm-hmm.
But in the dating world, in the Asian fetish world, I've also been called, down the street, China girl, Japanese girl, hey you. growing up, I was called China doll. I've been called the yellow persuasion.
Oh.
Yes, and then they'll say something like that along those lines as a way of endearment, I guess, which I always like, I don't really want to ever be called yellow, so thanks, though. I know I've gotten weird requests to dress up as things.
Oh, my goodness.
I've also gotten the request to be, like, a dominatrix, mm-hmm. and I think that has something to do with, like, the tiger mom ideas.
Right, or like the dragon lady.
Right, the dragon lady for mm-hmm. sure. As well as I've gotten all of the, I think Asian girls are hot.
Yeah.
I had one guy who actually was Asian as well telling me that he's always tried to go after Asian girls, but they don't like him. They only like white boys. And I was like, that was his introduction to me, by the way, online dating. And I was like, yeah, I'm not going to respond to that. Not sure how.
They only like white boys?
Like, Asian girls only like white boys.
Oh, I
see. That's what they're saying. And I'm like, I date white boys, but it's not because I only like white boys. Like, it's just, it was just a weird phenomenon.
Uh-huh.
I also, yeah, get the request of being tied up and being their slave.
Gosh.
Yeah. So, yeah, Asian fetishes. That happens a lot. It uh-huh. creeps me out, and it does prevent me from dating a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. I can see that.
Right.
I think that is completely legitimate.
Right.
Yeah, I've been hearing your stories about this for a while. So.
Well, and then because you and I also talked about the fact that I don't go to things like Dragon Con
mm-hmm.
because of the anime world, essentially. And not that that's all that Dragon Con is, but that's what, you know,
sure.
I think of, mm-hmm. as well as the fact, like, I stopped listening to Weezer
mm-hmm.
because of his obsession. I'm like, this is really kind of creepy when you start thinking about what he's referencing.
Is it
in my
what's
world?
Is it Pinkerton?
Is it Pinkerton?
It's Pinkerton.
I think it is.
From Miss Saigon.
It was just bad. And I was like, I don't want to be recognized as this.
Right.
And I know people have types and such, but it's just a whole different level of obsession.
Yeah. And we had a whole discussion about it. And so I thought to bring you on for this update would be prudent, would be a good thing. Because in that episode that I talked about with Sonam, we touched on these things, but we didn't really get to go into them too much. So in this classic episode, you'll get to learn more about the Hollywood stereotyping of Asian women.
Right.
So enjoy.
Yay.
Welcome to Stuff Mom Never Told You from HowStuffWorks.com.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Kristen.
And I'm Caroline.
And Caroline, we, on Stuff I've Never Told You, have talked about the spicy Latina stereotype, the Pocahontas princess Native American women stereotype, exoticizing women of color. And now today, we're going to dig into stereotypes about Asian women, and particularly East Asian women.
Yeah, and the thing is, there's not just, unfortunately, one Asian lady stereotype to zero in on for this episode, but the ones that we are going to dive into should be pretty familiar to a lot of our listeners. The idea of the dainty, submissive geisha, or the diminutive China doll, the angry, sexualized dragon lady, or the overbearing tiger mom. So all of these stereotypes should be pretty familiar to our listeners. We've touched on a couple of them in the podcast before, but we're really going to zero in on the fetishization of East Asian women.
Yeah, and the phrase that comes up a lot to talk about that kind of fetishization, particularly within American culture, with the idea of white men especially being particularly drawn to East Asian women, is the whole yellow fever, so-called phenomenon. And I realize that that is not the nicest way to put it. It's an uncomfortable phrase to even say on the podcast, Caroline. But that is, I mean, that's what it's called, for better or for worse. I mean, it gets at the slur and sort of the creating a monolith out of all of these women. It's the same thing as exoticizing women of color. It's just mm-hmm. a different brand of that.
And that exoticization of non-white populations is definitely nothing new. And in terms of the topic at hand today, well, we've been doing it since about the time of Marco Polo.
Yeah, I mean, essentially once there was Western contact with the Far East, the Orient started to develop that mystical quality. And then all of this gendering started to happen, not only of obviously like the women and men and like drawing, you know, stereotypes about the type of people they were, but even gendering the entire geography, because this whole issue of Western fetishization when it comes to East Asia is really a story of imperialism. And this was something that Patricia Park laid out really well over in Bitch Magazine in an article called The Madam Butterfly Effect. And like you said, Caroline, it does go back to Marco Polo's 13th century jaunt to China and the whole development of the Silk Road. And once there started to be those exchanges of goods and stories brought back from the East.
Right. Just like things that people in the West had never seen before, whether that was spices or fabrics or just, you know, human beings
yes.
that we considered to be so insanely different from ourselves. But it's interesting when you do look at that gender aspect, because East Asia as sort of a whole has been historically feminized in the eyes of the West, sort of as a reaction against its formidable strength. We could not come in and take over, essentially. We couldn't come in and be the boss. And so we ended up fetishizing entire groups of people and claiming the women for our own, us being the West and typically Western men.
Yeah, and this pathological fetishization is called Orientalism. And ultimately, it is an Occidental or Western attempt to masculinize itself and cement global dominance. And you see this fetishization of East Asian women happening, particularly peaking at different times, when on the flip side of that, a cultural castration of Asian men happens. And we're not going to have time to get into that on the podcast today, but just kind of keep in the back of your mind how while these women were being sort of elevated and sexualized, we were doing the opposite to Asian men in a lot of ways. But things really began to fetishize in earnest. And Caroline, if we had a dollar already for the number of times we said fetish, a version of fetish in this podcast, we could buy a sandwich.
Ooh, perfect.
Yes.
You're speaking my language.
But yeah, so it began in earnest, though, in the 1840s, after the Opium Wars opened up British access to China. And this was something that Patricia Park talked to Kim Brand about, who is an associate professor of Japanese history and an author as well.
Yeah, because suddenly you have these buttoned up Victorian men, as she calls them, confronted with the image of the Japanese geisha. This is a culture that had previously been closed to the West. They'd kicked the white people out. They were sick of them trying to make a buck through trading. And so Japanese culture had been pretty closed to Westerners for a long time. But once you have white guys returning to Japan, to China, to this whole region, they're sort of blown away at what they're seeing, especially when they are confronted with the women around them.
Yeah, so all of this leads up to the 1887 publication of the book that set off this whole thing. Even still today, we are seeing echoes of it in this entire concept of yellow fever. So in that year, a French writer named Pierre Loti publishes Madame Chrysanthème. Pardon my poor French pronunciation. And it is a massive hit. And the whole plot line will probably sound a little bit familiar. It's about this French naval officer who travels to Nagasaki and has an affair with his quote-unquote temporary bride, Chrysanthème, who's one of many delightfully diminutive doll-like women he discovers in Japan. And this whole tale is a huge, huge hit. There are dozens of reprints and translations out of the gate, and it is considered the seminal text that created the Western idea of East Asian women. So yeah. Thanks a lot, Pierre.
Yeah, I mean, this is part of the trend of white guys shaping how we view Asian women as a whole, where we get this whole idea, this whole stereotype of all Asian women being small, dainty, waifish women who are able to satisfy you sexually in ways that you've never dreamed of before. And meanwhile, though, I think it's important to note, this is just one of many of Loti's tales of exploiting foreign women that he encounters. So, like, traveling the world, writing variations on Madame Chrysanthème, just in different countries. Like, oh, well, now I'm going to exploit this country's women and this region's women over here, shaping all of them into these perfect little submissive dolls.
So he's basically the original globetrotting bro who comes home with so many stories you wouldn't believe the women, man. You gotta get over there.
That's right. And just like with those people, I would imagine that not all of his tales of conquest are true.
No, seriously. It's true, man. I'm telling you.
She lives in Canada. You wouldn't know her.
It was crazy. But Lodi's success in this whole story inspires another guy named John Luther Long, who writes a short story a lot of listeners have probably heard of, called Madam Butterfly. So now I don't have to try to mispronounce Chrysanthemum. And Madam Butterfly is all about a dude named Lieutenant Benjamin Franklin Pinkerton and his temporary Asian bride, Cho-Cho-San, who has his baby, who is then named Trouble, and then, spoiler alert, she kills herself.
Well, I think actually in the short story, they generously allow her to just attempt to kill herself, and then she gets to live out like a troubled and miserable existence with her child from then on out. But it's not until we get the Puccini opera of Madame Butterfly, which I believe is when that character kills herself.
Puccini's like, oh, you know what audiences love? Suicide.
Well, right, because then, so not only do you have the dainty, submissive, sexually satisfying woman, but you throw in some self-sacrifice into all of that to make her like the perfect lady martyr figure for a white guy?
Yeah, a woman who is so in love with you that when she can't have you, she kills herself.
Yeah.
Hello, what a dream gal. Yeah, Madama Butterfly premiered in 1904 and remains one of the most performed operas in the U.S. and abroad. And Caroline, is this the moment when we can take a quick side trip to talk about high school?
Oh my gosh, yeah.
So I don't understand how I got through so many of my years without putting these two pieces together. I guess it's just because I'm not a Puccini fangirl, like mm-hmm. maybe I should be. But as I was researching and reading for this episode, I was seeing the name Pinkerton, Pinkerton, Pinkerton. Oh my God, that was one of my most favorite albums in high school, the beloved second release of Weezer.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, of course, I realized listening to it approximately 1 bajillion times that he is singing about Cho-Cho-San and yeah. all this stuff. But I never put two and two together.
It sort of blew my mind, too. I can't believe in the number of times that I listened to that record growing up and even as a college student that I didn't realize that that's the connection. And I this whole time I had just been thinking Rivers Cuomo is just some sort of like creep with yellow fever fetishization of Asian women. And it's not that I'm necessarily wrong, but I was trying to give him the benefit of the doubt, thinking, oh, well, he just really likes Puccini or he really likes Madame Butterfly. Like, that's great, right? That's cultured.
That's emo. Although it's not really emo. Don't send me your letters clarifying why Weezer is not emo, please.
Well, so I did a little Googling. I wanted to better understand the connection there between Weezer and Madame Butterfly. But basically, in this Rolling Stone interview that I read with Rivers Cuomo, he goes on and on about how in listening to Madame Butterfly over and over again, he becomes fascinated with the character, with her character, and at the same time became infatuated with that type of girl that's in the opera. And he says that he identifies with the Pinkerton character because he's basically like the rock star of his day who goes from port to port picking up ladies. And I was like, no.
Well, I guess, okay, considering the popularity of Weezer, all right, Rivers Cuomo, you are a tortured Pinkerton. Maybe that's why he entered his celibacy phase for a while. But it was just surprising, again, that it somehow took this long. Thank you, Stuff Mom Never Told You, for putting the pieces together.
And it's also interesting to really just keep in mind that these stereotypes and this fetishization led to 100 years plus of this self-sacrificing storyline, because then all of this Madame Butterfly business inspired 1989's Miss Saigon, which is basically the same story but told about a Vietnamese woman rather than a Japanese woman.
Yeah, and if we move forward in our timeline, we'll hop back from Weezer, but forward from Puccini, when we're in the 20th century, we have the emergence of a new sexualized stereotype, the dragon lady. And this is the cunning femme fatale foil to the China doll slash lotus flower. And the term was coined in the 1930s.
Yeah, it was used to describe Empress Dowager Cixi as she was slanderously portrayed in British historian Hugh Trevor Roper's completely false account of his affair with her. Among other things, this guy claimed that the Empress had an oversized clitoris. So good for him, just slut-shaming women that he never actually had any sort of contact with.
Well, and that reflects how these stereotypes do tend to meander down to vulvar anatomy.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, vulvar is an adjective. It's a little awkward to say, but it does exist.
Yeah, it's just one of many that are vulvar related.
Yeah, and have to do with size and assumptions about size. Yeah. And that's something, too, echoing back to our podcast on big butts and the fetishization, particularly of women of color, and with the story of Sarki Bartman,
mm-hmm.
and all of that fascination as well with, or I shouldn't say fascination, but even just dark obsession with this idea that Native African women had different sized vulvas compared to white women as well. So all sorts of just horrible types of things like that going on. And one person that we wanted to talk about in terms of the portrayals of these stereotypes in Hollywood, once we move from literature and into film, in early Hollywood, one of the only Asian American actresses that you saw on the silver screen was a woman named Anna May Wong. And our cultural treatment of Asian women is so much reflected in her career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this really echoes the career paths of a lot of Black actresses during this time, too, who were often shuttled off into roles as maids, housekeepers, and the like. Anna May Wong, for instance, appeared in 60 films, always, though, as some type of slave, temptress, prostitute, or doomed lover. There was always some sort of subservient sexuality and sexual tension going on.
And we wanted to spend a little time talking about her biography and experience in Hollywood because, to me at least, it was so informative of how these stereotypes really took root and manifested in the United States. And I highly recommend, listeners, that you read the BuzzFeed piece about this written by the fantastic Anne Helen Peterson, who has also been on the podcast. She wrote a great piece about Anna May Wong, and it is a recommended read. And Wong was a Chinese American actress born in LA in 1905. And even the fact that she was born in the United States was something that Hollywood tabloids could never really wrap their minds around. Like, I know she looks Chinese, but surprise, she was actually born here.
Yeah, and I now, like, all of the articles about Anna May Wong put every modern fashion spread that discusses Asian-inspired fashion in stark relief because I don't know if the headline East meets West sort of originates, in terms of pop culture use, originates with Anna May Wong articles, but holy crap, like, that seems like they couldn't write anything else. They were so, everybody's minds were blown that this is an American woman born in America, in case you were wondering, who didn't speak with an accent, and they just couldn't get over the discrepancy there.
Yeah, and the treatment of Asians at the time that she was born is very much reminiscent of what we talked about in our Spicy Latinas episode, exploring how those anti-Mexican, in particular, stereotypes really started to creep in at this time. Because as Anne Helen Peterson lays out, in the 19th century, the first mostly male Chinese laborers start coming to the U.S., and then in 1882, you have something called the Chinese Exclusion Act, barring their entry to the country because they were believed to be immoral, unhealthy, and a threat to our fabric of society.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association member, FDIC. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI.
There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better.
In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces.
Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So this is the environment where things are happening. And there was also a lot of discomfort, too, with the fact that a lot of Asian women, because of these kinds of U.S. policies, were not allowed to come into the United States as well. There were fears that they would bring over things like STDs. So you had these communities of mostly Asian men that white people similarly were like, oh, what's going on over there? That's not right. There aren't any women. But at the same time, they judged their women as being immoral, too. So it was just a mess to begin with. And here's Anna Mae Wong, who grows up in L.A. and decides to be an actress.
Yeah, so she starts appearing as an extra in a few films being shot in Chinatown when she's like 14. She gets her dad's permission, and he only lets her go if she is constantly supervised and chaperoned by a bunch of big dudes. But she began acting full-time in 1921, with her big break coming in 1922's The Toll of the Sea, which is basically another take on the Madame Butterfly storyline. And, of course, her character's name is Lotus Flower. But despite the fact that she's a great beauty and a great actress, she's got this passion for acting, the racism of the day kept her from everything from attending Hollywood parties to even kissing her white co-stars on screen, thanks to things like California's anti-miscegenation law. She also was super afraid to be caught with any white co-stars out and about, in the same way that celebrities today, if their photo's taken and they're together, everybody automatically assumes they're dating or sleeping together, whatever. Celebrities back then, especially celebrities of color, were also subject to all of these assumptions. And so she was quoted as saying that she had to cut off a bunch of love affairs because she was so worried that one or both of them would get personally hurt or that professionally hurt.
Yeah, and so this is similarly reflected in the roles that she's offered, because she could only ever play either a more sympathetic character who has to kill herself, like a Cho-Cho San because her exotic love is doomed. And also, P.S., they can't show them kissing, so it's not like they can really have a romance blossom. Or she would play a dragon lady temptress who tries to thwart romance between two lily white leads. So not exactly much of a range she was, you know, at liberty to explore. But the tabloids loved her. This was one thing that Peterson noted, that unlike, say, black actresses of the day who would not have gotten any coverage at all, because Anna Mae Wong was lighter skinned and still exotic, and the fact that she just wasn't black, they could still talk about her. She would never make the cover of a magazine.
Right.
But, ooh, she made for just such tantalizing content, as we would say in the internet age today.
Right, and one of the descriptors that they tended to use for really Asian people in general, but definitely for Anna Mae Wong as well, is talking about her ancient race. There's always this discussion by white media back then, and I don't know, maybe today, about the ancient races of Asia, as if we have somehow excavated from some block of ice, like entire groups of people who've just been around alive for centuries.
Giving them like the dinosaur treatment almost.
But yeah, so along those same lines, one of the fan magazines of the time said that she reminds us of cruel and intricate intrigues, and at the same time, of crooned Chinese lullabies. She brings to the screen the rare comprehension and the mysterious colors of her ivory-skinned race.
Whew. So considering that climate, it's not terribly surprising that she never really broke through America's outsized racism to become an A-lister, unlike one of her gal pals, Marlene Dietrich, who she befriended when she moved to Europe, where things were a bit more liberal. And she was even passed over at certain times for Chinese character lead roles that were instead cast with white ladies. For instance, in 1932... Madame Butterfly, the movie, starred Cary Grant as Pinkerton, which that broke my heart a little bit because, yes, did I have a childhood crush on Cary Grant?
Oh, for sure.
Totally.
Mr. Blandings Built His Dream House?
Hello.
Hello.
I know someone who can fill that dream bedroom. And his Cho-Cho-san? Oh, well, Sylvia Sidney. Of course.
Famed white lady.
Yes.
Famed white lady, Sylvia Sidney. And there were all of these magazine spreads at the time, kind of behind the scenes of these films, detailing how they transformed white women into Asian characters, which was just a lot of, like, racist, awful, like, here's how we pull her eyes back and put her in yellow face and make her talk with a broken English accent. It was all pretty horrifying. But there was, Anne Helen Peterson points out over in that BuzzFeed article, a film version of the book The Good Earth, which was not perfect in its depiction of Asian people, but still a little bit better, a little bit more rounded. And so she points out that MGM offered Anna Mae Wong the role of, again, Lotus, a slinky tea house dancer who seduces the main moral character and becomes his second wife. But Anna Mae Wong actually refused the role because at this point she'd been to Europe. She saw that it could be better. She saw that her friend Marlene Dietrich was getting these great roles. She saw that white women were portraying Asian women all on screen everywhere. And so she said, "You're asking me with Chinese blood to do the only unsympathetic role in a picture featuring an all-American cast portraying Chinese characters? No thanks." So she turned that down and basically stepped back from large roles.
So by the time we get to World War II, when relationships between, say, the United States and the Japanese become far more complicated, to say the least, this relationship is already so dysfunctional. We already have these ideas firmly ingrained in popular culture. And we're going to talk more about World War II and the Lotus Flower Revival when we come right back from a quick break.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs.
on demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association member, FDIC. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI.
There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better.
In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces.
Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So once World War II happens, and then we're involved in the Korean War and in Vietnam, American soldiers and Americans in general are put more in contact with Asian cultures than really ever before. And they're dealing with them in ways that they've never really dealt with them before. And of course, unfortunately, one of the ways in which American GIs and Asian women become involved is through the sex trade.
Yeah, I mean, of course, there were actual relationships that might have been taking place, but there was rampant prostitution that was happening, also rape between soldiers and local women. And again, we return to this era of gendering of the East, of sort of re-feminizing this area of the world, which certainly isn't a coincidence because, yet again, you have this Western power, the Occident, like trying to reassert its dominance to be the masculine world power. And it's Madame Butterfly all over again, culturally, with similar stories that we've talked about in the first half of the podcast, repackaged repeatedly, only this time with more white guy savior twists and prostitutes with hearts of gold.
Yeah, and Kristen put together a list, and I've only seen one of the movies on this list, and that's South Pacific, which premiered on Broadway in 1949. When I was growing up, my dad was such a huge, like, Broadway and musical fan, so I'm definitely familiar with South Pacific. But in this era, you also get 1957's Sayonara. In 1960, you get The World of Susie Wong. And in the 80s, we see Miss Saigon, which is set in Vietnam, as we already mentioned, but also Full Metal Jacket, which coined some more unsavory pop cultural references with the whole "me so horny" line that we've heard, not only from that movie, but it got also shuttled into music as well.
Yeah, and today we still see Hollywood peddling stereotypical roles for Asian actresses. They're either model minorities, you know, the nerdy kid in class. They're dragon lady businesswomen. They're sexy kung fu masters or non-English speaking immigrants running dry cleaners, or they're prostitutes. And if we move away from the big screen to the small screen, television is slightly more progressive, as it usually is, but just slightly. It's not like it's the land of plenty.
Yeah, of course, Grey's Anatomy fans will recognize Sandra Oh's name. She was probably my favorite character, definitely was my favorite character on Grey's Anatomy back when I used to watch it. And her character's existence was certainly not built or shaped around her race at all. You also have Lucy Liu, who I love too. She went from being sort of the resident dragon lady on Ally McBeal to a more well-rounded character on the show Elementary as Watson.
And then on Glee, you have Jenna Ushkowitz and Hetian Park on Hannibal as investigator Beverly Katz. And this was really interesting. So, spoiler alert for those of you who are not caught up on Hannibal, Park's character was written off the show. And I won't tell you how. We'll just say that she was written off the show. And there was a fan outcry, partially because it is still relatively rare to see Asian women in these more well-rounded roles. And she took to her blog to personally respond to the fan outcry. And it really, you know, gets at how this issue is still alive and well in Hollywood. So she wrote, quote, "I'd rather focus on the positive stuff. I got to play this amazing woman who didn't have to sleep with anyone or act dumb and girly or fawn all over some guy to be conniving to get people to notice or respect me. And she didn't speak broken English or karate chop anyone. Not that I would have minded. Nobody called her Dragon Lady or exotic."
Yeah, it's just that whole idea of normalizing diversity and having TV and film represent our everyday experience, what we're seeing on the street. And so not having a character, like I was saying with Sandra Oh on Grey's Anatomy, that's built entirely around someone's Asian-ness. Having an Asian actor or actress be able to play just a character on a TV show. And over at Salon, though, they point out that two particular Orange is the New Black characters aren't as well-rounded as they could be. And those are the characters of So-So and Chang, that they sort of hew stereotypical, and that their backstories either haven't been fleshed out enough or that they haven't gotten as much play as some of the other characters.
Yeah, it seems like Kimiko Glenn's plotline playing So-So is a little less stereotypical. Like, if anything, she, you know, portrays the mental health realities that can be associated with not only, well, being in prison, but also these model minority expectations that, you know, do sometimes happen within Asian American households. But with Chang, up until this most recent season, I mean, she was very much just a stock character and a little bit of comic relief. But I remember watching it, I mean, long before, obviously, we were searching for this episode and thinking, like, huh, okay, that's kind of an outlier, especially before So-So came along. She was the only Asian character and rarely spoke.
Yeah, well, in that Salon article, the writer was like, well, I'm not trying to argue for more Asian women in prison, but the whole underrepresentation of Asian characters in this show that takes place in a prison does sort of reflect the existing stereotype of Asians as the quote-unquote model minority, that they never do anything wrong, they just study math and get good grades and get married and go on to be model citizens, when even if some people do think that that model minority stereotype is positive, like, hey, we're not saying that you break the law, so shouldn't you be grateful? It's still squashing entire groups of people down to a one-dimensional representation that doesn't reflect reality.
Absolutely. Well, and speaking of squashing down a culture to not reflect reality, very briefly, this is something that we've seen female pop stars in particular pedal out with some of their acts. I mean, this is more of a bigger conversation about cultural appropriation, but this is also, too, recycling some of these fetishistic images that we've talked about. So I feel like the conversation really got started way back now in the olden days of 2004 when Gwen Stefani released Love Angel Music Baby, and as part of her shtick with that, she hired on the Harajuku Girls posse to not only appear in shows and backup dance for her, but just to be her posse everywhere.
Well, to be her accessories.
Yeah.
I think is what a lot of people took issue with, as you can really claim about any type of cultural appropriation or plenty of stuff that musicians do in music videos. You know, there have been plenty of people like Miley Cyrus and Taylor Swift who've been accused of similar things, but with African American women. But in 2013, you also have Katy Perry at the American Music Awards recycling that tired geisha image of the cutesy, diminutive, submissive woman
carrying the little parasol, wearing the kimono.
Yeah.
And then also in 2013, Avril Lavigne's Hello Kitty video was very much Japanese schoolgirl. A lot of people weren't too happy about that. Her defense was, hey, I shot it in Japan and the director was Japanese. I love Japanese culture, which is why a lot of this really meanders over more to a conversation about cultural appropriation than these kinds of this fetishization that we're talking about. But it's still related. It's all part of the same ball of wax.
Yeah, because whether you're fetishizing someone or you're appropriating part of their culture, you're still just taking a tidbit of information that is oftentimes false or misrepresentative and using it to represent entire groups of people. And it's definitely something that you see play out when you do talk about romantic or sexual relationships and dating and the way that people who are accused of having yellow fever are talked about.
But there's still pervasive stereotyping, especially when it comes to relationships between white men and Asian women. And I'm not just talking about, you know, fetishization that some white dudes might have, particularly for Asian women, but I'm talking about from the outside looking in too, and our outside assumptions when we see those couples and the whole yellow fever thing of saying, oh, well, he must be like that. She must be like that. They're like XYZ.
Yeah. And Patricia Park, in that Bitch article that we cited earlier, talks a lot about how everyone from comedians to frat boys to whoever recycles a lot of that, to borrow a phrase, ancient praise of Asian women's supposed physical perfection. The fact that they are small and petite everywhere.
Yeah. This is something, too, that Karen Ng wrote about in also in a Bitch article that was published in 2000 called The Yellow Fever Pages. And it cited in so many pieces that talk about this. And she wrote, the fantasy Asian is intelligent yet pliable, mysterious yet ornamental, perpetually prepubescent, ageless, and petite. And she comes from a culture where women traditionally serve men. So, you know, you package all of that up together and you get yellow fever. Meanwhile, too, we have the more cultural castration of Asian men in the United States. And there is some disturbing evidence of that, especially if you look at the sex industry, especially in Southeast Asia, and sex tourism being the primary tourist attraction in Thailand.
Yeah, and then you combine that with the fact that you've got all of these websites that are dedicated to matching up American men with Asian women, and that's a huge market in and of itself. It's almost like a new type of arranged marriage.
And then far more casually and anecdotally, in the United States, there's the kind of the offhand suggestion to say Asian girlfriends of like, oh, you know what? You should date this guy because he loves Asian girls. And a huge YouTuber, Anna Akana, made a fantastic video about this in which she just said, no, stop, shut it down. Don't do any of that because it's kind of racist and insulting, basically. And there, in fact, is an entire documentary called Seeking Asian Female about online dating specifically to find an Asian bride. And it was made by Chinese-American documentarian filmmaker Debbie Lum, who follows this guy, you know, as he seeks out a girlfriend and wife. He wants an Asian wife, and particularly a Chinese-born woman, and he meets her online. He travels to China. She comes back with him. They get married.
Yeah, this guy, Steven, definitely wasn't portrayed in the best light. That's a nice way of saying he was definitely portrayed as a creep And his wife was definitely portrayed as someone who was just seeking a visa. So this wasn't a glowing representation of white guy meets Asian girl, they fall in love. This wasn't sort of a fairy tale story. And not surprisingly, Stephen did not love being portrayed as this pathetic white guy with a massive fetish. And he left this huge comment on the NPR story, which was fascinating. But he says that, you know, lightheartedly, he could accept the dismissive and negative phrase yellow fever. But he says, in reality, that sounds far more strange than how I view it, like an affliction rather than a preference. But you have to keep in mind that he was explicitly seeking out Asian women and that he zeroed in on Chinese women after communicating with countless women. And realizing that he liked the communication style of Chinese women more. So whatever that means.
Well, and even the notion that you like the, and I don't, maybe he gets into this more in the documentary. I would hope so. Because as someone, Caroline, who spent almost 3 weeks in China, I'm an expert. But the very idea that it's like saying, oh, I like how American women communicate, where it's like, wherever you go, it's going to be a little bit different. Regional differences, especially if you go to China, big differences depending on where you're going in the country, where she grew up, what her family dynamic was like.
So wait, are you saying that like women can be different?
I'm saying people can be different.
Oh my God.
Yes.
Crazy. But, you know, a lot of people would argue, as Stephen might, that this is just his preference, the way that somebody might like a blonde mate or somebody else might like somebody who's tall. That this is just a preference.
Yeah. I mean, I will be completely honest. I mean, because why not? I've only ever dated white guys. It's not that I have not dated guys of other ethnicities because I have, no, but that has been what I've been attracted to. So I could see, I can see how you can play it both ways of like, well, maybe that's just my biological innate brain, you know, mechanics leading me to my now, you know, blonde, blue-eyed fiance. What a dreamboat. He's like a Ken doll.
But I mean, other people would say, well, that's just social influences.
Yeah.
And so there could definitely be some social influences that led the twice divorced Stephen to see that his son had married a Japanese woman whom he described as very agreeable, to then decide, well, I'm going to pursue Asian women. I'm just not sure what type yet.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's kind of no way around it in his case. But regardless, though, of the fact that I think, you know, that does exist in some situations, that does exist. There's also, too, side note, Caroline, one thing that I wasn't able to find any analysis on. But jumping from that, the stereotype of especially the white geek guy being extremely attracted to Asian women. There's this whole comic about it called Charisma Man. You can Google it, and it sort of sums up the whole thing.
So like Rivers Cuomo?
Yeah, like Rivers Cuomo. Yeah, Caroline just made a geek face because it does get to a point with that of like, wait, what is really going on here? What are these dynamics? Not to like demonize all of, you know, anyone in this situation, but just wonder what those dynamics are.
Well, sure, especially because whether you're Asian or whether you have Asian friends or family, you're probably familiar with the horrors that a lot of Asian women face on dating sites. I mean, yes, all women, hashtag all women do face horrific messages and things like that on dating sites. I was definitely the recipient of a few when I used to be on OkCupid back in the day. But Kristen and I have a friend who used to be on a couple of dating sites, and the abuse that she would suffer from men who were saying horrific things that were based purely on her race, purely on her Asianness, I just don't know how you can say that. It's not an Asian fetish. I just like Asian chicks.
I mean, it definitely speaks to the power of these stereotypes, going back to old Pierre Loti.
Mm-hmm.
Come on, Pierre. And it's unfortunate because when we get out of stereotype and fetishization land and into Attractionville, you know, you have plenty of healthy, real-world relationships between Asian women and white guys. And because, though, of all of that stereotypical baggage now, they have to deal with assumptions. This was something that Victoria Chan wrote about over at Vice, basically saying, like, you're, like, these stereotypes are making my relationship unbearable sometimes because of the things people say to me, the jokes that I'm expected to endure, and also just this assumption that my boyfriend is a creep.
Yeah, it is that dual awfulness of having to endure casual racism. One of the examples that Chan gave was they went to her boyfriend's family's place over the summer and they were going to play beer pong. And people were like, hey, you'll like this. It's just like ping pong. Yeah, your people are familiar with that, which I think she was talking about caused a fight with her and her boyfriend, and he apologized on behalf of the person. But so you've already got to deal with the pressures of one member of the relationship having to deal with racism, whether it's explicit or implicit or direct or indirect, and one not, one being, as she says, the privileged middle-class white guy, but then also having to deal with assumptions about your relationship. Like, that stinks that people are just looking at you and being like, ugh, Asian lady and white guy? Your boyfriend must be a creep.
Something's twisted. Well, and she brought up, too, the assumptions that, well, she must be ashamed of her heritage. Or she's just, you know, why doesn't she want to be with an Asian guy? What does she think is wrong with those guys? Which, again, is unfortunate because these relationships exist. I mean, if we look at marriage, as of 2013, 28% of Asian newlyweds in the U.S., partnered up outside of their race. And this is coming from the Pew Center. 37% of Asian women married someone who isn't Asian, and compared to 16% of Asian men. So these couplings are, like, totally common, you know, but so unfortunately weighed down with this baggage, which so unfortunately just relates back to imperialism and the Occident just being gross jerks.
Yeah, it was sort of crazy to put it all in the perspective that so many of the stereotypes that we culturally hold about Asian women in general come from just some white guys who went into a previously pretty insular, closed society and wrote books or plays or operas about it. And so that's what we think of Asian women. Thanks a lot.
And what do we do then, Caroline? What can we... The change starts with us.
The change start. Yeah, just like that Michael Jackson song.
Yes.
Podcasters in the mirror.
So one thing, though, that we can do on an individual level to make life a little bit easier with all this stuff is stop the questions of, oh, but where are you really from? Oh, no. I know that you were born in the United States, but I mean, where are you really from?
Yeah, because then all that does is echo back to this articles about Anna Mae Wong, who people were like, wait, you're Chinese, but you're also American, but you were born here. Why don't you have an accent? Where are you from? Where are you really from?
Because all of this really just amounts to a giant pile of othering. Mm-hmm. And while you might think, oh, I don't perpetuate these kinds of stereotypes, there are more of those microaggressions, we could say, that we can all probably pay closer attention to. And seriously, friends, if you have a single Asian friend that you want to hook up, don't suggest the guy who exclusively dates Asian girls. You know, like don't pull that whole thing.
Yeah, because then that just makes you feel, or makes your friend feel like she's just another widget in a collection of things. Like, if you were to say, Caroline, I've got this guy for you. He's really into short girls.
He only dates girls with bangs. You'll have a lot to talk about.
Yeah, hairstyling and tall shoes. That just enforces that nobody could be possibly interested in you for you and your personality. but that something about you physically or culturally is the biggest, most important part of you.
Well, I'm really curious, though, Caroline, to hear from listeners who might experience these kinds of stereotypes, unfortunately, in their relationships or in how they're treated in their dating experiences, whether they might be like a white guy who is has been interested in or dated or married to an Asian woman or vice versa. Mm-hmm. We want to hear from you. What are your thoughts on this kind of stereotyping? Or is this just something that you can block out and just completely disregard as nonsensical? Because a lot of it really is. MomStuff@HowStuffWorks.com is our email address. You can also tweet us at MomStuffPodcast or message us on Facebook. And we've got a couple of messages to share with you right now.
So I have a letter here from Christina. She says, I just wanted to say hi and tell you how much I enjoy your podcasts. I've been listening for a few years. You make mowing the grass and running fun. Oh, wow. Mowing the grass fun. Okay. She says, as a woman who's consistently worked in non-traditional types of jobs, I love the girl power feeling I get from listening to your topics. I think there has been some progress in attitudes towards women in male-dominated professions, but there is still so far to go. I've been a military police officer in the Army, a civilian city police officer, and now I work in the firearms industry. If I had a dollar for every time a customer calls in and assumes I'm the receptionist or asks for someone who can answer a technical question, as if there is no way I would know anything about those scary things that go bang, I could retire tomorrow. My coworkers are all male and no one ever calls and assumes they cannot assist them. I've even had several occasions where I've been told straight up that they want to speak to a man. Most of the time, I'm happy to just surprise them by showing that I do, in fact, know my stuff. I hope you guys have a great week and keep up the awesome podcasting. Well, thanks, Christina. Keep up the awesome listening and knowing things about those scary things that go bang.
Well, I've got a letter here from Abby, and she writes, I'm in a gender and work sociology class at the University of Georgia right now, in which my professor has so graciously exposed my classmates and I to your podcast. For this short summer course, we've been required to listen to 7 of your podcasts, but 7 has simply not been enough for someone like me who is so interested in educating myself on gender type issues. Side note, we give that professor an A+. That's so cool. We're part of a syllabus, Caroline.
I love it.
In recently listening to your podcast on bi erasure, I found myself getting excited and somewhat sad at how true everything you were saying was. As a bi/pan woman in a hetero relationship, I find my queer status being questioned all the time. I recently faced some complications in my relationship where I admittedly cheated on my significant other with a woman. I felt terrible. But when all of my friends found out afterward about how much of a toll the instance had taken on my relationship, I ran into my favorite question. You only hooked up with a woman, so why does it matter? People were insistent that had I cheated with a man, my significant other would have every right to be heartbroken. But since it was only with a woman, he was overreacting. Some people even dared suggest that my significant other should have only been upset because he wasn't able to watch the interaction. You can imagine how invalidating this was to both my sexuality and to his emotions. This also touches on your mention of female bisexuality being more accepted. I think it's important to note that true female bisexuality is not actually accepted at all. Instead, it's a hypersexualized idea of girl-on-girl physical contact we so often see in porn that's truly accepted. I hope for one day where sexuality need not be so defined, and that a queer individual's sex life must be exposed so explicitly in order to be justified. Thanks for all of your hard work. And thank you, Abby. And that is horrific of your friends, and I hope that they came back and later apologized. So, if you have any emails to send to us, momstuff@howstuffworks.com is where you can send them. And for links to all of our blogs, videos, and podcasts, including this one, with links so you can learn more of the history of these Asian stereotypes, head on over to stuffmomnevertoldyou.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association member, FDIC.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, berry lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.